Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. I'm John Marzalek, a host for the podcast Queer Voices of the South, a LGBTQ+ studies channel podcast of the New Books Network. Today, I'll be talking to Matt Brim about his book, Poor Queer Studies, Confronting Elitism in the University, published by Duke University Press. In Poor Queer Studies, Matt Brim shifts queer studies away from its familiar sites of elite education toward poor and working class people, places, and pedagogies. Brim shows how queer studies also takes place beyond the halls of flagship institutions, in night school, after a three-hour commute, in overflowing classrooms at no-name colleges, with no research budget, without access to decent food, with kids in tow, in a state of homelessness. Drawing on the everyday experiences of teaching and learning queer studies at the College of Staten Island, Brim outlines the ways the field has been driven by the material and intellectual resources of these institutions that neglect and rarely serve poor and minority students. By exploring poor and working class queer ideas and laying bare the structural and disciplinary mechanisms of inequality that suppress them, Brim jumpstarts a queer class knowledge project committed to anti-elitist and anti-racist education. Poor Queer Studies is essential for all of those who care about the state of higher education and building a more equitable academy. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm excited that you're here, too. I wondered if you could begin by telling our listeners about yourself.
Sure. My name again is Matt Brim, and I am a professor of queer studies at the College of Staten Island, and or CSI. And CSI is one of the colleges within the City University of New York, or CUNY system. And so what I do at my job is I teach LGBT literature and culture and queer studies, or sometimes called LGBTQI studies.
Great, great. And I'm guessing that when you tell people that you teach at CSI, you get jokes about the old TV show.
Yeah, especially being in New York.
But, that's right. Yeah.
But you know, the thing when I say I teach at CSI and I teach queer studies at CSI, they don't know what to ask about first, because the CSI isn't what the one they're familiar with. And for most people, queer studies is not a discipline or a field that they're familiar with either.
I'm going to come back and ask you about that. That's one of the questions I have for you. But first, I wanted to ask you, you know, how you came about writing this book.
Sure. So this book is really, you can think of it as a workplace report almost. And so I teach at the College of Staten Island, and this is a very working class, working poor, middle class, public higher education institution. And we have open access. We serve, we offer an associate's degree as well as a four-year degree and master's. And I think we have one PhD even. But it's an open access college so that we don't have admissions requirements. We admit 100% of the students. And so I was trying to figure out, the book came from a sort of confusion on my part. I was trying to figure out how to do my job, which is teach queer studies, at a college that serves a student body and that has a whole institutional identity that was really different than the places where queer studies is usually taught, and the colleges and the institutional identities of the colleges and universities with which queer studies is most readily identified and associated. And so the way I got to that idea, which was basically that I didn't quite know how to do my job as I understood it at this new place where I was hired to work in 2007. And that's because I hadn't ever been at a school like that before. I had gone to undergrad at a small, pretty rich liberal arts school in Indiana, where I'm from, and then to a big flagship university, Indiana University. And then I did a postdoc at Duke University. So obviously in the South, well, everyone knows Duke, I guess, but Duke is an incredibly deep-pocketed, well-resourced place, and it is also the birthplace of queer studies. Mm-hmm. And so I found myself coming from a three-year postdoc teaching really smart, really advantaged students, being around faculty who were at the cutting edge, so-called, of queer studies. And then I came to the College of Staten Island, where a college that I had never heard of before, and a college that the students going to school there, almost all of them had not heard of queer studies before. And so that makes for a really interesting problem, which is, how does this field that I know from one angle fit in with this college that sits within the university world at a very different angle? And so that's sort of the story of how I came to think about writing a book that ended up being called Poor Queer Studies.
Makes sense, because you've taught at two different institutions on different sides of the spectrum in terms of the number of privileged students, I suppose you could say.
Oh man, it's so one of the things we should say is that higher education in the U.S. is incredibly stratified or mm-hmm. separated by class status. And that's mainly the class status of its students, how much money their parents have, socioeconomic status, but also their familiarity with college. And so we have a kind of hierarchy or a pyramid. And at the top are the schools that we're all familiar with because we know their names. And when we picture college, a lot of times the images we're given of what college is come from those campuses. And so often it's Ivy League or very selective, as I said, very rich colleges. And even though those images come to mind, they're actually a tiny, tiny percentage of where college actually happens in the U.S. The pyramid is much bigger at the bottom. And so, you know, half of our campuses, college campuses in the U.S. are community colleges, and almost half of the students in college are community college students. And more people are familiar with the community college experience than any other kind of college experience, even if they didn't graduate. So higher ed is is really different at the top and the bottom. And so, and really different in terms of the material resources and the material conditions mm-hmm. of how it actually feels and looks and is like to learn and to teach on those campuses. And so you're right, the difference couldn't have been more stark. And it's, you know, it's from little jolts like that. I didn't go looking for this book. I was jolted into thinking, oh my gosh, what's happening? Why is this difference in class and material resources so important to the field and to how the field is taught and to how we teach this discipline of LGBTQ studies?
Yeah, that it's wonderful when you find something like that jolts you, like you said, that you find you want to write about like that.
Yeah. And I knew that, you know, I've always been interested in pedagogy or teaching. And so I've wanted to write about students and the classroom experience for a long time. Mm-hmm. And even maybe thought about writing a book earlier about queer pedagogy or, you know, queer mm-hmm. teaching. But I didn't have what ultimately would become the most important thing to me, which is a class and race analysis, because not only is the university stratified by class, socioeconomic status, but it's deeply, deeply, deeply race sorted, so that black students are funneled in one direction and white students are funneled in another direction, and Asian students are sort of funneled in different directions, and even Latinx students are sort of funneled in more diverse directions, even though they're mostly pointed toward the bottom of the pyramid. And class and race are not synonymous in higher ed, but they largely mirror each other in terms of their locations. And we like to make a lot out of the fact that sometimes there are exceptions to this class and race rule. We like to make a lot out of the fact higher ed and the schools at the top of the pyramid like to make a lot about how they're expanding and diversifying in terms of class and race. But the statistics, the data actually show that the improvements are very, very, very minor, and mostly we're stuck. Especially in terms of Black students, we've reached a plateau.
I really like the image that you used of a pyramid. I hadn't thought about what you said, but it's the idea that more of the students, more of the college experiences that people have, are at the bottom, which is the largest part of the pyramid.
Yeah, and it's where most queers are. So the other part of
that's
this,
a good point.
The class and race analysis is drives the book, and when I say class and race analysis, I don't bring heavy theory to this book. I just think about the students in front of me and the classrooms that we're in, and do they have access to technology or not, and what did they say? Are they mothers? Do they work full time, which most of our students do? So a class and race analysis actually just means paying attention to the details of your work site, right? For me, that's what it means.
Yeah.
Those details are also there. There are a lot of poor queer people. And most queer people are poor because most people are poor in the U.S. And that's the same in education, except the poorest people in our country don't get into higher education at all, right? And so
that's right.
So one of the blank spots in this book is attending to the queer people who never matriculate.
Maybe that's another book for you down the line.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe
that's right. I wanted in the beginning of the book, you say that you're frequently asked these two questions, and so I thought I just had to ask them to you to see what you said to people. But you said that people often ask you when you say that you teach queer studies. People say, "What is queer studies?" And then they follow up with, "Why do you teach at CSI rather than Columbia or NYU?" So what do you say to them?
So when I talk about my field, I sort of do a bit of a historical answer, and that is queer studies started out called something else. It started out being called gay and lesbian studies, and that in one version or another has been going on for a pretty long time, even within higher ed, since mid-century, in the 60s and certainly 70s. And so people, gay and lesbian people, and some others were trying to think about, well, what is our history? How do we research ourselves? And that's incredibly important work. And then a little bit later in the 80s and 90s, we got to say, well, queer studies doesn't have to just be about gay and lesbian people, because gay and lesbian people don't. That's not the extent of non-heterosexual experience. And we started questioning, are identities stable? We know that sexual identity changes over time and over history and in one's own personal life. And we also became much more clear about one's never just LGBT or queer. One is always raced and classed, and one is from a particular place. And so...
All the intersections.
Yeah, exactly. And so now queer studies is really attentive, or at least it always needs to be attentive to all the kinds of differences that make a difference to people who do identify as queer. And so that's the answer I sort of give. And just in terms of my own work in the field, my first book was on James Baldwin, and so I'm really interested in Black queer studies. Once you do work in like Black queer studies or Latinx studies, you can't just sort of go back to whatever kind of queer studies you were doing before, because you've seen how important those other registers and frameworks are to the field. And so that's just a sort of encouragement to maybe undergrads and grad students to not think about doing queer studies, you know, as a thing in and of itself, separate from critical race studies and working class studies. But the why don't I teach at Columbia?
They haven't offered you $1 million, right?
They have not yet. Any day now. I moved, so maybe it's in the mail.
Right.
You know, the question isn't why don't I teach at Columbia. The question is who teaches at Columbia? And the people who teach at Columbia went to Columbia or another Ivy League school. So one of the things about Ivy League schools and very selective schools isn't just that they admit the richest students, which is true, and isn't just that they pay faculty more than any other college, which is the case with Columbia, but they hire, they only hire, now I say only, and somebody's going to come up with an exception.
let's
say that the rule is the rule. And so when we try to overlook the rule, we're motivated to do that. I want to say the rule is the rule. Mm-hmm. Columbia and Ivy League schools hire from Ivy League schools. And that is, why is that? Is that because Ivy League schools, graduate programs are producing the best PhDs? Well, that's what we're told. That's the myth of meritocracy. And we're told that all of these selection mechanisms that allow people to rise to the top, those selection mechanisms have good, good processes by which the best are promoted and hired and advance. And I am here to tell you that that is not true. but it is one of those things that it's very tough to crack into that shell of self-perception around what is the best in education. And I don't come from that kind of background. And so trust me, if Columbia wanted to hire people who were not graduates from the Ivy League, they could hire people that are a lot better than I am. So this isn't about me not getting into Columbia, right? This is about Columbia excluding the kinds of professors that they also exclude at the level of the student body.
Well, you know, it's interesting as you say that, because you really see the same thing in politics. I remember in the last presidential election, you know, political pundits talking about the number of presidents who had come from Ivy League schools.
Yeah. And the Supreme Court, right?
I mean, so right. That's right. This whole club in the Supreme Court. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what that does, the reason that makes a difference, and I'll just bring it back to the book for a second.
Yeah,
the reason
of course.
That makes a difference is because the ideas you have about yourself and the world and the people around you are informed by the people around you, and the micro worlds that we live in tell us a lot, often through implicit messaging and lessons about what is good and right and how, and just true, what is real. And so when you have the pandemic, for example, you have the very first person who came out with a big national megaphone was the president of Brown University, and Brown University is an Ivy League school, and had a big front page story in the New York Times. Now, it's not easy to get a front page story in the New York Times, right? You already have to have a megaphone in your hand.
That's right.
That makes your voice really loud. And that megaphone looks like money and power. And so when the president of Brown University comes out and says, here's how universities have to reopen, and here's what we need to do. And this was very early on. This was spring of last year. Mm-hmm. Everything that she said required tons of resources. And yet she was talking about college generally, not just about Brown. But you have to afford, you have to buy tests. You have to have a population that you can house if they get sick in somewhere. What about community colleges? What about under-resourced colleges? I mean, there were all of these quote-unquote solutions to this universal problem that only would work for not the universe of college students and campuses, but for only the tiny tip top of colleges and campuses. And it turns out those solutions weren't great anyway, because colleges, students just shouldn't have gone back.
That's right.
but it was the mindset that you would know what is best for all because you have been told that the knowledge that you have, the world that you see, and the solutions to the world that you see are the solutions that work for everybody. And that is one of the downsides of being in a tiny little, I call it provincial, having tiny provincial rich knowledge, is that you think the reality is as you see it, but the reality for most people is not that at all. And so the world of queer ideas, insofar as it's shaped only at high class, very elitist, very exclusionary institutions, actually does, my question in the book is, how much does that actually teach us about queer life? Is there not knowledge that comes from below that we need to pay attention to? Knowledge that we are creating, but we don't have the big megaphone to shout to the world, listen to this, it's important.
Well, that's a perfect segue into my next question, which is, you know, you talk, obviously, in the title of the book, you have poor queer studies, but you also talk about rich queer studies. And I wondered if you could, you know, tell our listeners what the difference is and how you see this relating to what you started talking about, the state of affairs for queer studies in higher education. And I just quoted you there.
So rich queer studies is sort of I use that to mark the institutional history of this field of queer studies. Now, rich queer studies has given us incredible and a wealth of knowledge, amazing ideas, right? There are these luminaries in the field who have been at exclusive and selective colleges, but it doesn't mean their ideas are bad, right? Their ideas have actually been incredibly powerful for a wide range of people, even people at colleges like mine. We use those ideas, we adapt them, we make use of them. And so I want that flow of ideas to continue to come to us. That flow is down. But those ideas can't stand in for the whole. And so what needs to happen too is that rich queer studies needs to be informed by the ideas happening in my classroom. So rich queer studies doesn't know, for the most part, what a queer commuter student knows about the experience of being a student. Rich queer studies doesn't know what it's like when you have not just some returning students, but you have many returning students, 50, 60-year-old mothers who come back and sit in your queer studies classroom, not as single individual mothers by themselves, but there are multiple mothers in every class. What does queer studies know about what they bring to the classroom and what their ideas, how they can inform the field? And let me give you an example. So one of the great things about queer studies happening at the top of the academic pyramid is they've given us really good ways to think about language and language practices. And often they're at the forefront of thinking about what words we end up using in the field and to define the field and to define ourselves. And all of that is really valuable. At the bottom of the pyramid, or let me say, be a little more descriptive, if you have working class students, if you have first generation students, if you have a lot of black and brown students, language in their lives can operate really differently does operate really differently than somebody telling you the right word to say now is this word, right? As the most progressive kind of advanced knowledge we have about queerness. This is generational as well, but it's class and race based. And so if sexual knowledge helps us to understand ourselves, and this is for everybody, and a certain kind of sexual knowledge is being produced along class lines, then people in those classes are going to believe that they have are going to have certain kinds of sexual knowledge that is not shared by people necessarily who are having a different class and race experience. And so what they think of as saying, the words they think of as maybe the right words or the progressive words or the radical words are words that sound, that ring a little hollow in ears of people who have different kinds of sexual knowledge that help them get through life. And even if it's just cope, that language, that sort of class and race-based language is how we make it through. And to be told that we can't have these tools, these language tools around queerness that have helped us make it through and cope and survive, And to be told that from people who have a lot of advantages, it just doesn't work.
It's interesting because it reminds me of, you know, writers talking about the rural and big city divide among queer people and in queer studies itself.
Yeah, there's some great work done in rural queer studies. I mean, you know a ton of it, right? You've done it. And I'm from Indiana. And, you know, you sort of can never leave home. I mean, I'm never going back to Indiana.
The Hoosier State,
which is maybe more south than the geography would imply.
Yeah, definitely. It's a red state. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Rural queerness and urban queerness can have whole different narratives about what it means to be queer. So like there's this whole kind of narrative about queer people needing to escape to the city. And this was my case, right? I'm not undermining this idea that queer people need to escape to the city to find people like themselves and to experience a kind of critical mass that allows them to mobilize around identity and to be political and to just live a life in community of many other people like themselves. And that doesn't often happen in rural settings, but that doesn't mean that rural queers don't have really intentional and valuable queer experiences that they prefer and that help them live their lives, you know, like not leaving their families, not leaving the kind of working class environment that defines most of their life and that informs their queer life. Maybe they have kids. Maybe a lot of rural people were in heterosexual relationships and had kids, and maybe they don't want to leave their kids. You know, rural people tend to have kids early before they can come out. You see this with Black women in the South. There's a lot of great work around Black lesbians in the South who are staying in the South, right? And there are lots of reasons for that, including family reasons.
Well, and you know, in ways, you have such a nice chapter in your book called "Poor Queer Studies Mothers," and there seem to be similarities in some of the things that I, you know, that at least I've experienced interviewing people in the rural South. And I just wondered if, you know, you could talk about that chapter a little bit and why you decided to include a whole chapter on poor queer studies mothers.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's chapter 4 in the book, but really that's the heart of the book. That's where the mm-hmm. book started. And so it just takes a while to get readers to the point where they would be able to look with me and believe what I'm saying and believe my students, right?
Yeah,
I think people won't necessarily be able to believe students and working class and working poor students right away and think that what they're saying is actually valuable and knowledge producing. So it took me a while to get to that chapter. The chapter is, so poor queer studies mothers, I actually just mean, I have a lot of mothers in my classes, like women who are mothers, right?
Right.
And I have a lot of parents, but I focus on mothers. And sometimes, of course, mothers do most of the care work. And we have a lot of single moms. And we know that sometimes our students who are mothers can't find childcare, or sometimes there is domestic abuse in the home and they need to get the child out. And they also have this incredible life of the mind, and they're college students and they want to think and they want to learn. And the classroom is a place where they feel good and safe and are able to articulate their good ideas and share what the work they've done for the class. And they don't want to give that up. And why should they? And so sometimes those two things, having to be a mother or being a mother and being a student and wanting both of them, those come to a point where those two things have to happen at the same time in the same place, like in the classroom. So mothers bring their kids to class, is what I'm saying. And I guarantee this does not happen like at a place where your class has no mothers in it, right? I'm not saying there's a judgment about mothers at colleges that don't enroll many students who are mothers. I'm saying that experience doesn't exist there. And so you're not able to think through that experience and listen to that mother in the classroom, and you're not able to listen to how the peers respond when a mother brings a child to class. And they respond incredibly generously and inventively. And, you know, we don't say dirty words in front of kids usually. And yet in queer studies, we say a lot of words that a kid might think are dirty, right? We say gay words, and we use, you know, words that are, we have discussions about, should we use this word? Is it an okay word to use? Well, we can have those discussions out loud in class usually because we've created a space where we trust each other and we're adults. But you bring a kid in and, you know, sometimes a four-year-old, you don't want to say those words out loud. And so my students start to spell those words because they think we still need to do the work of our class, but we need to change how we're doing the work of our class because there's a changed environment with a kid here. And yeah, how creative and brilliant is this? And then once you start spelling quote unquote dirty words, that allows a whole, a whole thought process of, is this word a dirty word? Should I be spelling this word? What do we say in front of a kid? Is queer bad? Is gay bad? So there's this whole intellectualizing and rethinking of our process of using language, and that would not have happened. This is just one example. There's so many that wouldn't have happened if that kid hadn't been in the room.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, so many, at least, you know, going to school, through my college experience, so many professors would not allow mothers to bring their children in if they didn't have childcare. They would say, you're going to have to, you know, find another way. So you have a different philosophy on this, it sounds like.
Well, think about this. So if you say to the mother, you can't bring your kid in, then the mother's not in the room.
Right.
If you say to a student, if you're more than 5 minutes late, you can't come in the room. I'm locking the door. Or you only get so many tardies. Well, if you're in New York City, we have an incredibly defunded public transportation system. Our students get to campus on public transportation. If because our Democratic governor has not funded the MTA, our public transportation, if the buses and the trains are late all the time, then when we tell a student you can't come to class if you're a little late, what we're actually telling them is that the MTA is their problem. We give that problem to them as though it's theirs. Or we're asking them to be hyper responsible, leave way, way early, and therefore maybe if the train does run on time, get to campus super early. Is it my job to tell a student how that they have to get to campus super early, to leave home super early just to get to my class? That's a huge imposition. So there are all these, and this is totally a class issue, right? For our students who drive, and we have a lot of students who drive, is the parking on campus such that when they drive to campus, they can find a parking spot to get to class? Or because our campus is so poor, have we not provided the structural capacity for them to make their way to class on time because there's enough parking? You know, it's all about the material conditions in which we live that leads up to and informs the classroom experience.
Yeah, and the issue that you bring up about how someone's privilege enables them to have even more privilege in higher education, it just really stuck with me as I read your book.
I don't think rich queer studies has confronted its own advantages at all, almost at all, in these terms. I hear professors talking about their students who they care very much about. These are great students. I think these are probably generous students. My students at Duke were, I think these are generous faculty members. I think it's much easier to ignore the role that the material conditions of your work site create when those material conditions become invisible because they all work, because the classroom is heated, because the window goes up or down, because there's parking, because there's transportation. I think when all of the structural components become invisible because they work, it becomes harder to think about how the structural components, the material conditions, actually inform one's work life. And part of our work life is teaching, and part of our work life is research. At CSI, none of that is invisible. Every bump, you feel every bump along the way to your education.
Yeah, you know, but the students I work with in counselor education in our diversity course is one of the things we talk about. And I'm sure there's a lot of different, you know, programs talk about this, but you know how someone can get so stuck in the worldview, it's like they have blinders on. And it sounds like that's what you're saying, that when somebody is not forced to remove those blinders and see the other side of things, they just never even realize they're there.
And there's an ugly other side to that, and that is that we know that poor students who are admitted to selective colleges, you know, what we normally think of as good schools, or the schools that occupy the top of the best
list, pyramid, yeah.
the rankings. Yeah. We know that when they get there, they very quickly understand that it's a place that they don't understand, most of them. Now, some poor students, as Tony Jack writes in his book, The Privileged Poor, were able to go to boarding schools and sort of rich prep schools. They got often scholarships there. And so they have more cultural knowledge of what it's like to be in that environment. But a lot of poor students don't have enough familiarity to know how to be in that place.
Yeah.
And they're incentivized not to talk about that, right? So it's we know that students at a variety of schools, including a great liberal arts school, Williams, poor students have started Twitter feeds about how they can't talk about being poor at Williams because they're ashamed of it. And not just that they're ashamed of it, but that they are shamed by others about it. And so when the dark side is that it's not just that there is an invisible kind of floaty holding rich queer colleges up, right? There's this buoy that allows you to do your work, but you act like the buoy isn't there. But there's also a pressure on the people who can bring a different voice not to voice their experience. And that is just and that's called class quietude, and it's just a classist dynamic that I certainly can't tell those colleges how to fix.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of just really becoming aware when I was in graduate school that I had so much privilege because my father was a retired college professor. And so I knew the resources I needed if I needed them. I knew where to go because I learned this growing up. But then when I'd meet first generation students, I was surprised initially that they didn't know where to go, like things like financial aid, because they'd never been told about it before.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a problem, for higher ed generally, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of what I think about in poor queer studies is that big framework of the higher education problem. But then I also want to think about how those of us who are in different fields, different disciplines, in my case, queer studies, but maybe you're in sociology, or maybe you know, you're in mental health counseling, or maybe you're in economics. I want to think about within that higher ed picture of advantage and disadvantage, how do our own fields fit within that? Are the ideas that we have, how is the knowledge we're creating, how are the pedagogies that we're taught participating in that class stratification, class quietude, racism, racialized capitalism, right? That says to some people, take on a ton of debt. You have to take on a ton of debt in order to get ahead. And if you're Black, you are under a special pressure to take on extra debt because in education, you have to get a higher education than a white person without that education.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
What are all of the ways, not only that higher ed is setting the framework, but within our own fields of queer studies, you know, we used to think and still do about queer studies being white. But silently white, being done by white academics. And I'm white. I identified as a white gay man. And we didn't think about how is the field actually maintaining the structural racism of the university, right? It was just sort of implicitly white, or the whiteness was not seen as a quiet problem, right? It was just seen as not voiced. And now we know not to do that, but queer studies hasn't yet fully reckoned with, and I think hasn't really begun to fully reckon with, the way that we uphold class norms within the field and therefore support upholding class norms within higher education generally.
Yeah, and this might be a good place to ask you if you would talk a little bit about, I think it's chapter 2, You list some myths of rich queer studies, and I wondered if you could, you know, talk about some of those myths without giving all of them away, because we want people to still have, you know, something they want to go back and get the book, of course.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's this thing called the job market. You know, you're going to get a PhD and then you're going to become a professor, right? And that's how it sort of used to be. And it sometimes happens, but that's not the normal story anymore. And one of the, I think, assumptions that has, I think it's being broken down a little bit now, but I think it still persists at elite schools, is that if you go to Yale, that means you're brilliant and you come out of Yale more brilliant. And that brilliance is testified to by your brilliant advisor at Yale, who will write you a letter of recommendation that will say you're brilliant. Right? But so the problem is that what is getting the person the job? Is it that they've proved they're brilliant, or is it a kind of very insular network of people and institutions sort of verifying and locking in the myth that this person is brilliant? We know that there's a lot of work that comes out of top schools that's amazing. We also know there's a ton of academic work that comes out of top schools that is absolutely mediocre. So why is that? Why is it possible the mediocre work comes out of the places where the people who produce that work are the most well-resourced? They're given the most support in doing that work. When there are people, and again, people will think that this is sour grapes on my part, and that's fine. But there are people who I know at my college or at other CUNY schools, like community colleges within the CUNY system, who are producing incredible work, right, that doesn't get called brilliant in the same way.
Well, I don't remember what chapter it is, but you actually list, I guess, you know, you have this whole list of publications that faculty at CSI have published, and you talk about CSI's storied queer background. You know, I think it's really fascinating. How did that end up happening there?
Well, you know, so this book got written by me, my name's on it, but this is a product of thinking through my job with other people who work at CSI with me, as well as with students. So this is really, you know, and so that chapter, I was trying to really say, there's a collaborative nature of queer studies work that's being done here, but so much of it under the radar. And so I wanted to take the book and sort of tweak the form that we normally see academic books take, and that is putting the bibliography at the end of the book. What I did is I took all the queer work happening by faculty at my college, College of Staten Island, and I put it within the chapter where I was talking about the faculty, the queer faculty of College of Staten Island, because I really wanted to highlight it. And a lot of people have said to me, well, that's really boring looking at a bibliography. But other people have said, oh, wow, that's a really long bibliography. Look how much work has been done in queer studies at the College of Staten Island. Why isn't the College of Staten Island well known as a place to go to learn and teach queer studies?
And that's what I thought when I saw that bibliography. I was so impressed.
Yeah, me too. That has nothing to do with me. That has to do with these incredible colleagues that I have, that I'm lucky to have, and who have fostered my own growth there. And we rely on each other to do that. But a lot of that is unsung, or at least it goes under the radar. And the real problem with that is that, not that we don't get really high-paying jobs, it's that the ideas that are so vital, that come out of teaching the whole people, that come out of thinking about what public higher education should be, or that higher education should be public, the problem is that those ideas often don't get shouted out to the world and redistributed by the publishing mechanisms that tend to reinforce the hierarchies and academic elitism that we see.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I have so many questions to ask you, and I think we have about 15 more minutes, so I better jump into the next one real quick, because I could talk forever on some of these topics with you. Yeah, you had this great line in chapter 3, or this great term. You talk about that you want to prepare students to, quote, cause queer trouble. And I wondered if you could talk about that.
Sure. So I want them to be able to cause queer trouble at a particular place. I want them to be able to cause queer trouble at work. So one of the things that
is true of students at CSI and at almost all colleges is that our students are also workers. So they come to class from work, they go to work from class, they come to class only at night because they work during the day, they come to class only on the weekends because they work during the week, and often they're full-time workers. And so when queer studies, as it often does not thinks about a kind of class rebellion or a kind of class analysis that is radical. It's for, it's anti-capitalist, which I of course agree with, right? Well, almost to the point that some of those critiques don't think about actual working people's lives. They think about the larger system of late capitalism. But when you're teaching queer studies to a group of students who just came from work, and you're trying to make queer studies relevant to their lives, you're not doing that by only making it relevant to them as queers and who they're having sex with and what their gender is, right? You're making it relevant to them as whole people. And it happens to be true that the whole people in our classroom, one part that makes them whole is that they're workers, and that they're workers already, and that they're going to college to get jobs so that they will earn a little bit more money as workers in the future. Now, if queer studies doesn't say, how can we help those students on the job? How can we give them queer knowledge or queer strategies, a queer perspective that will allow them to go to work at the toy store in the mall? As my student says, one of them said, and when the mother comes in and her little boy wants a quote unquote girl's doll, and the mother shames that kid, that girl, my student and the worker can think, okay, can I intervene here? Right, it's very hard to intervene within in families, right? Families are sort of off limits somehow. But what could I do? And so that's a problem she has at work, and it's a problem she sees and that she wants to be able to fix, or at least to try to fix, but maybe doesn't know how. Queer studies can give her a lot of information about how queerness and sexuality is privatized within families and how it's nobody else's business. It can give her a lot of information about how gender works in kids and what gender identity is and how to talk about gender identity and how to think about how people have, and parents especially, have a lot of panic around their child's non-normativity around gender and sexuality and what the histories of that. You know, it can just enable, not that the student would then teach the mother, but it can enable a kind of really well-informed reaching out. And that the danger is that reaching out will be rejected. And of course that happens. Work sometimes isn't a safe place to make trouble, but they're going to work after class one way or the other, and they want their work lives to be better. And for many of them, they think their work lives and they know their work lives would be better if they have queer knowledge on their side.
I absolutely love that. It just makes me think about how what you're doing is trying to bring queer studies out of the ivory tower and bring it into the real world.
Well, what's amazing isn't how that happens when I teach my students and really teach with the students. What's amazing is what happens when the students go and teach people in their home communities. Now, this surprise to me. Students go home from my classes. Of course, they live with their families still. It's a commuter college. Most of them live with their families, which is a big difference from elite education. And I sort of assumed, this is my fault for assuming this, that their queer studies class would be this hidden away thing that they don't talk about with their parents or their coworkers or their friends. What I learned is that many students really love becoming the teacher of queer studies to people outside the classroom and off campus. They're very interested in the ideas. They say that the people they're talking to are interested, not that they agree, but that these discussions are sort of there, right? They're ripe to be had. And so one of the assignments I give students is to talk about everybody you've taught queer studies to this semester that is not a student in this queer studies class. And the answers that come back are just fascinating. And sometimes they're a little depressing, but mostly it shows students taking charge of this knowledge. And as you know, as a teacher, you learn when you teach.
That's right. Yeah.
And so they're not just, they're really reorienting themselves to what that knowledge means in their lives.
I love that. It's really, it's very creative too on your part. How is this related, if it is, to the term you use, queer faring? I'm not sure if I said that right. Queer faring.
Yeah. So ferrying, like a
that's
ferrying
it. That's boat. It. Yeah.
Yeah, like a boat. And obviously, I'm sort of playing off the idea of the language.
The ferry. Yeah. Yeah. It's fun.
Which is some of that outdated language, but you know, within gay communities, we use that word all the time.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
About ourselves and our friends, but. Okay, so the end of this book is sort of my effort. I think a lot of the book seems like I'm pitting rich and poor colleges against each other. And maybe the discussion we've had today, I've done that as well. Well, poor colleges are never going to win that fight. Like, there's a reason things are like they are, and that's because power and money win, and because they're allowed to structure our institutions. So we can't just have a sort of animosity between rich and poor. We can't just say that you're not looking at me down here and you're bad for doing that. We can't just have rich queer studies saying, well, I'll pat you on the head and say, you're doing really good work there, but I would never teach there, right? Because I'm doing real scholarship or whatever. We can't have that. And when you talk to other queer studies scholars in person, you know, we're not those kind of ogres that take one side or the other, but we are very much constrained by the structures we're in. And so if the structure says we're kept apart and we're kept opposed, then we need to say, not do I have good feelings about you and let my good feeling about you, who's very differently situated, make me stop saying there's a problem here, but can we work together to overcome or deconstruct the hierarchy. And so queer ferrying means, how can we go back and forth, ferry back and forth between different class and race locations in higher education, from top schools to bottom schools, and of course, middle schools. And one big criticism of the book, which is really valid, is that I don't talk about middle schools that much, but I've exposed the extremes because I ultimately want to say that the rich and poor need to be trading and sharing the kinds of knowledge that we create and the kinds of resources that we have. And those don't necessarily look like the same kinds of resources. It's not all trading money or ideas. But if we could go back and forth between each other's work sites and see what's happening there and share what our students are saying with each other, is there a way that we could sort of thread together the ideas or at least give each other an expanded vision of how of what the next years of queer academic thought could be, rather than siloed off from each other, and the ferry as a symbol comes directly from my experience teaching in the College of Staten Island, because I take the ferry. There's a ferry.
Oh yeah.
Oh, the Staten Island ferry, this big orange thing. If you've seen Working Girl, you've seen this ferry.
Yeah, that's right. All right. That's exactly what I was thinking about when you said that. That's funny.
Yeah. And I take that ferry, and that ferry goes back and forth between Staten Island, where my job is, and Manhattan, the rich island where I live. And so I know that going back and forth between different kinds of places changes the way you see the world, because I do that on a daily basis. And so if we can move, not necessarily make everything into one, but if we can move more efficiently and more effectively and more regularly back and forth between the places, what will that movement create?
So many metaphors there. That's really, really great metaphors. I wanted to ask you also about, I think it's chapter 5, you talk about reading for queer blackness. And I wondered if you could tell the listeners about that.
Well, the first thing I want to say is everybody should run out and get this collection of short stories called Counter Narratives by John King.
And you talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so this book changed my life. This book, not just, I've read a lot of black, gay and queer literature, having done all the work on Baldwin and just sort of been in the field. But Keene's book, Counter Narratives, sort of made me think, I don't know how to read. I don't know how to read what he's writing. He does this deeply historical, deeply fine grained, storytelling about, black and queer and Latinx lives across history. And the way he tells story made me recognize that, so much of what we read is actually relies on this underlying storytelling principle of being pro-white or being pro-straight. And those messages come at us all the time. We actually don't have strategies and stories that tell us how to learn the strategies of how to read for a pro-black or pro-queer protagonist or even not protagonist, just sort of possibility, right? Mm-hmm. A story that tells me without saying it explicitly that black queerness is a creative possibility in the world, and it always has been, is a story that I was not raised to be familiar with. And I wasn't raised not just in my youth, but in my formal education, K through 12, college, and grad school. And so, in other words, that's knowledge, that's a kind of illiteracy that has been created around the inability of the publishing world really to put books in our hands that are able to use pro-black, pro-queer narratives as their underlying structure.
That must be so eye-opening for your students and exciting for your students in your classes.
I think so. I mean, it's they see how excited I am by it, right? And first of all, John Keane's book is so amazing that it does so much of that work. It does that jolting work that we talked about earlier. It does so much of that jolting out of our normal way of reading and our normal frames for understanding eroticism, desire, race, that it becomes exciting in and of itself. It's very difficult, that book, but it becomes exciting in and of itself. And then when you get to share that excitement in a classroom, that's where teaching and learning become just runs away with itself, and the contributions among people who are excited to be reading in a new way. And of course, a lot of students at CUNY are black and brown students. And so I think it means something special to them to be able to not just see themselves in terms of there's a representation of a black character or a brown character, but to see books that don't weave whiteness under the story as the goal, the ideal, the endpoint, the standard.
Yeah, you all in that chapter, you also cite E. Patrick Johnson, and I guess using the term jolted, that's how I felt when I read his book, Sweet Tea.
Yeah.
Black Gay Men of the South. It's just such a wonderful book.
E. Patrick is actually one of the biggest influences on my scholarship because he's never written anything that doesn't think about class as well as race and queerness. Like every bit of scholarship that he does integrates that. And Sweet Tea and then Honeypot, right?
Honeypot,
in the South. Yeah, I'm sure that those books for you are just really fun to read, given your own similar work.
Yeah, I think you called him the architect of poor black studies, I think you said.
He's one of them, yeah, and a very important one, and came up with queer studies, which is a word that how his grandmother pronounced queer. And it's important to say, so he's not just taking queer as it's normally heard and said and meant, but he's routing the great queer ideas we've been given in lots of places. But he's saying the way he first learned about queerness and the framework for understanding all these great new ideas is his rural, poor, black upbringing in North Carolina. And hanging on to that vision of class and race as a way to engage with new ideas that don't necessarily start there. Finding ways to put his own experience in conversation. He's just a master of it.
Yeah, and you know, coming back to your book, I think for the listeners who maybe aren't really familiar with queer studies, I think that you're going to find that you learn so much about what's out there just from reading this book because of the different authors that you cite and the different topics that you consider.
Yeah, well, my real goal is not for people to say, I'm going to be interested in this book because I take queer studies classes or I know what queer studies is, right? I want people to understand that there is a kind of thinking that I'm doing in my little world of the university that's really hopefully portable and adaptable to other places where we should be thinking about how class and race structure the institutions that we're in, right? Religion and government and even family. And you know, the ideas that I try to talk about in the book aren't ideas that I want people to say, this is the template and I have to use this idea exactly as is. It's, I want people to see ways that the ideas can be malleable and useful for them in their own ways. And so it is definitely a book about poor queer studies, but the subtitle is Confronting Elitism in the University. And confronting elitism, if there's nothing else from that title that makes sense, I think is that we're in a moment where people say that is necessary work in every aspect of society and culture. Elitism is one of the things that's choking so many people in this country. The preference for the richest, the assumed superiority of people with advantage. It's and the blatant use of that power and privilege to harm the poor. Right, we're thinking about right now unionization and the Amazon factory in Alabama. The only reason that everybody's not on the side of that union is because there are very rich people sending out very powerful messages about how Amazon and Bezos are good and how he is the goal. We all want to be like him, and how factory workers don't know what's best for them and they aren't a model that we should aspire to. And that's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you say in the book that queer studies is the lens through which you look at this whole issue in higher education and obviously in the country as a whole.
Yeah. I mean, it's, as I said, higher ed, that there's no, in my opinion, there's no institution that's better than higher education at this unfair work of sorting people out by class and race. The sociological data, it's just staggering. But higher ed is just one of the institutions that does that in our country. And you mentioned earlier, you know, government. But if we found all the ways that the wealthy aren't just privileged, but their privilege is maintained, and that maintaining of privilege seems normal and right. I want to undercut that within the university. I want to privilege other people and places and classes and races than are usually the privileged ones. Not because I'm PC. I mean, I am PC, but because there's so much good work that's happening there that it goes unseen. And if you're just asking people to join your team because you have righteous indignation, you'll get some people to join you. But if you actually show them, look at what you're missing if with the system built like it is. Look at what doesn't get valued, even though we say we value it, if the system and the structure is maintained as it is. I'm trying to do that in higher education through my field of queer studies, because I think you have to start making change where you're at least I do. I'm not very good at thinking about theoretical change and arguing for broad. I think we have to talk to people where we're at. And so that's how I hope the book can be useful to people, even when where they're at isn't where I'm at.
Well, you're doing a form of, you know, taking your term queer fairing, not only, between queer studies programs, but from higher education into the broader society.
I mean, you should write the afterword to my book and just say that exactly.
Okay, yeah, next time, yeah. And your next book, Matt, that'd be great, yeah.
Thank you, I'll take you up on it.
Okay. Well, believe it or not, we've come to the end of the hour, and I still have so many questions I'd love to ask you, but it's best that I don't, because it's going to really encourage our listeners to go out and get your book. And I just want to thank you for joining me today.
I can't thank you enough for thinking about the book and reading it and giving me this chance to share it with other people. Thanks so much, John.
Oh, yeah, great. You're welcome. And to our listeners, if you're interested in reading Poor Queer Studies, you can click on the highlighted title of the book in the description included with this podcast. And of course, you can also go directly to the Duke University Press website. And join us again next time for Queer Voices of the South on the New Books Network.